Dr. Abramowitz subsequently moved to Washington and earned her doctorate degree in philosophy at the Catholic University of America. She did additional graduate work in economics at American University, also in Washington, before assuming her present position as Assistant Director of the Domestic Council. Dr. Abramowitz was Senior Fellow of the Institute for the Study of Educational Policy at Howard University. There she authored several monographs and two books on equal educational opportunity in higher education. She's a former employee of the D.C. Public Schools, began her career with the school system as a clinical psychologist, then became a research and planning associate on the Fort Lincoln Newtown Project, and later was executive assistant to the superintendent. Dr. Abramowitz has also worked as project director for the College Entrance Examination Board, executive director of the National Association of School Psychologists, and a research coordinator for the Institute for Services to Education. In addition to her publications while at Howard, Dr. Abramowitz has written articles in educational evaluation, testing minority children, equalization, and education for the handicapped. We welcome her today as she will tell us what her current position in the White House entails. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for that kind introduction. I work on the domestic policy staff, and I do in two areas. I work in education, and I work on women's issues. And the time that we have here, I'll say briefly what the major educational issues are, and then more substance on what we're doing on women's issues, because it seems more of the moment. Yeah. On education, my function in life is to try to provide what is hopefully good advice and good recommendations on all federal legislation in education and on all budget decisions for the federal government in education. Now, my advice goes through Stu Eisenstadt to the president. That's my link. And it's a very nice link, as some others have said. He's a super kind of person. He's one of the original Georgia Mafia and a very nice guy. You know, if you ever have the opportunity to meet him, he's very open-minded, too, and very good. Good civil rights lawyer out of the South. On the major education issues, those that I want to highlight would be for higher education legislation. Although now, for those who follow education, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and other major elementary and secondary education pieces are going through a reexamination to determine any necessary changes before they're reauthorized and they once again come into effect. Now, of those pieces, the greatest concern about women would, of course, be the guarantees against sex role stereotyping in the curricula, which is not directly in the legislation, but is a general feel that goes along with most of it and is reflected in Title IX, as well as the general concern that girls, as little people, and women as professionals are not discriminated against in the implementation of any of those laws. Now, that's been less a problem in elementary and secondary education programs because of their very nature. But it's been more a problem for racial minorities and ethnic groups. If you were to put where the real problems are in terms of policy development and operation of those laws. But in higher education, I'll say a few words, you do find the kinds of sex-related problems that would be of moment here. Now, and that, I think, the major piece, and it's one thing you might want those who are interested in that whole area look at now, and that's the Higher Education Act, which is the omnibus act for higher education and sets the tone of what the federal government will do. Now, federal government does two things in higher education. Well, it really does one thing, and that's give out money. But it gives out money for two different purposes in higher education, one for research, the other for student aid. And it's the student aid function that's had the greatest impact in changing the complexion of most campuses around the country and provided the greatest opportunities for access. Now, within that, now, that major piece of legislation, and it is major. When I say major, I just want to put dollars around the student aid part. We're talking a good $3 billion. Now, when you consider this, now, I'm talking for the fiscal year 78, the legislation is tied up in Congress over abortion. Now, when that finally springs loose, and it will, the whole education division budget will be about $11 billion. And out of that, a sizable chunk will go just for student aid. So it's not a small effort, and it's something that is well worth paying attention to, because those are big dollars, both in the aggregate and on an individual level as well. Now, there are, what the major programs are and why I think it's important to pay attention to it from the point of view of women. The major programs, of course, are the basic grants program. And, well, I don't know if everybody here who knows someone 18 or knows someone who recently came out of high school and went to college or who decided to go back to college as an independent student may be familiar with these programs. So, if you want to tune out, please do. For those who may not know about them, I'll run through it very quickly so we'll all have the same common frame of reference. There is a basic grants program. Now, how this operates in essence is you apply to the federal government for money, and it's given on the basis of need, and there's a maximum amount that can be received, and that's $1,600. Okay. Now, you receive less than that depending on other things about your family ability to pay, whether or not you're full-time enrolled, and there are whole sets of standards around it. That's the biggest program. And that's a direct relationship between the student or the student's parents and Uncle Sam. And that's the only program that operates in such a direct way. Everything else is indirect. The other programs, quickly, the supplemental grants program, which you receive by the federal government gives the money to the college. You walk up to the financial aid officer. You say you're in need. They review the record. They decide or do not decide you're in need. They give you money. And then you go forth less poor than you were when you came. And that covers tuition and room and board. The other programs, of course, the work-study program, you know, in which the federal government pays, what are they paying now? Schools pay 80%. Federal government pays 20% of the cost of the jobs on the college campus. You march up to your personnel office. You cop a plea that you're in need. They agree that you're in need. They give you one of the work-study jobs, and that's supposed to help you pay your way through school. That, incidentally, is probably the most popular program because it adheres to our own Protestant ethic, which says it's better to work your way through than to get a free ride. So that's always a program that will be there. The other one that's relatively new but rather important is the State Student Incentive Grant Program. The federal government plunks down some money, and it gives it to the states. The states then commingle it 50% with their own, and they give out grants. Usually they're used just within the state. So California has such a program. Every state in the union does. Texas does. It goes under different names at the state level, but they're always half-funded by federal monies. It's a 50% match. Now, why all of this has some implications for women in particular is not just the fact that they are expiring and they will be reauthorized, that is, renewed, but also the fact there's an opportunity to make some changes in it, and there are some changes that are important to note. Now, and if you work in that area or care about it, it's a thing to pay attention to. One, of course, is the fact that for most of the programs, you must be enrolled on a full-time basis. Okay? Now, you match that against the college-going patterns of women now, especially those returning to schools, and you see where the mismatch is. Okay? You must be enrolled on a full-time basis. You also must be in need, that is, if you're a married woman, this works to your disadvantage. You and your husband is earning over $8,000 a year. You have a problem because you will not meet the incomes test for most of these aid programs. Yeah. And if you are a widow or divorced woman or displaced homemaker by whatever means, and you were left with a house in which you have an equity of more than $17,500, then you will probably not make the test either and will not be eligible for aid, nor will your children. Okay. Now, so that what you find among older women, and that's the group that's going to college more often now, if you project the enrollment trends over the next 10 years, the people going to college are women, and they're going on a part-time basis, and they're going in continuing education. That's the group. And the financial aid programs as presently constituted are not available, which means that there's no assistance in meeting the cost of college. So one major aspect now is to look at those federal student aid laws, which are big bucks, and determine what redirection can be put in them to enable more women to achieve easier access to college. Now, the women who are suffering from that are not professional women who want to go back and pick up training in another area or want to make a mid-career shift. School teachers, they don't want to be school teachers anymore. That's a classic group. They can get the money together to meet the tuition costs. It's women who want to move into professional categories, who want to move out of secretarial pools and have children or with or without husbands, who generally don't have the access to higher education to carry on major redirections in their life and are forced to rely upon whatever sort of upward mobility programs are inherent in wherever they're working. Or if they have the good fortune to live near a two-year college or a public four-year college, or live in a state where such programs are available and they have space. But those are the women for whom these pieces of legislation do not offer adequate assistance and the attention that we have to give to it now that there's the opportunity to do so, and the sensitivity. So I stress that to say that it's a critical piece of business. It's on the face of it, it sounds fairly innocuous and downright boring, but it makes a great deal of difference in whether or not you want to go to higher educational institutions. And as displaced homemakers, it's absolutely important. Because if you have a house, as I said before, and I can't say it too much, if you have a house and very low income, and you've got college-age students, then unless they're emancipated, that is, unless they're independent and you no longer claim them on your income tax, then they probably will not benefit from the federal program, which limits their choice and their access to college. And that's a major piece that needs to be worked on, and indeed is. Now, with that brief aside about education, and I'll talk about what we're doing in other areas vis-a-vis the status of women, period, in the broader sense. Now, the other half of the hat that I wear is on women's issues, as I said at the outset, and it's a broad piece of business. Now, I'll tell you how I decided to cut up the pie, and other people may want to do it differently, and if you have any comments about it, I'd like to hear it. What I did for myself was say, and I said it in one of our meetings, you know, we'll start on the plantation. The federal government is the largest single employer of women, and it is one of the major employers in this country. And federal expenditures are now up to 1/4 of the gross national product. So how we do business affects a lot of things. And if you can't get your own act cleaned up, then you're not in a very good position to talk about other people. Before you reform IBM, let's try to get our own thing together and make it better. So I staked out that as a first place to start. And it just so happened that it was the right moment in history and the right sets of people were in the right places to make things possible. I think when Mary King was speaking earlier, she referred to Scotty Campbell, who is the commissioner of the Civil Service Commission. When you're talking about the federal government and the status of women, you're talking about two types of workers. The political appointees, such as myself, who disappear in 2 years, 4 years, 8 years. Okay? And that's a very thin veneer. If you're talking about reforming the federal government, you're talking about this group, the career employees. That's the bulk of the workforce. And they will be there. Some like that and some don't, but they will be there. And that's the thing you have to impact on if you're trying to improve status. That's an aside, that political appointments are important, and having women in them is a very critical piece of business, but alone it's not sufficient because you've left untouched the bulk of the workforce. So it's a good start, but it's not an ending. Now, I had the great good fortune to be here now as opposed to perhaps 8 years ago or perhaps, and I can't say in the future because the future should never be different. It should always be better from what it is right now, and I'm that hopeful. But as I said, Scotty Campbell is the commissioner. There are two other people with him, Jules Sugarman from New York, who's got a good civil libertarian record on his own, and Ursa Poston, who is the first black woman ever to be made a civil service commissioner. Now, with that little team and the president's mandate to carry on major civil service reform, some very exciting proposals have come forth that will make a difference in the bulk of the labor force. You know, we've already done two of them, and that's the beginning. I'll tell you what they are briefly. One is to do nothing more, and I take no credit for it because all I do is know how to read. If you can read, you can do a lot of this stuff because it's all been written down before. God knows it's repetitive. You know, the recommendations are not new. It's a matter of actually working with most of them. But the federally employed women and other groups have been trying, and I dare say many people in this room as well, have been trying to change two little pieces. One is to increase part-time work. The other is to increase flexi time. Yeah. Now, those are starting points, but they almost get to be symbolic because they're related to women, and evidently it's been like hell to get done. But what the president had committed himself to do and what we have done, two things. First, try to push the flexi time bill through the Congress. In order to expand flexi time, it requires legislation. Now, as a rule of thumb, it's better if it doesn't, because you can do things more quickly through an executive than to have to run through committees and hearings and go that whole thing. It takes forever. But there was no choice on flexi time. So, much to the surprise, evidently, of a lot of people, President staked out the position on flexi time. And I'm very pleased that he did, too. I support it. We're in favor of it. We're doing our best to get it through Congress. And when the session reconvenes, we will continue to push. And there are lots of good people up there who want it. That's one little piece. Now, for those who are not familiar with it, what that enables you to do is vary the workday. So that if you have children, or if you want to do other things during the day, you can break up the schedule just so long as you achieve a 40-hour work week. Now, why that takes legislation? It's because of union contract problems and other codes. See, you know, I have to say that the unions initially were against this because if you wanted to work a four-day week, 10 hours a day, to achieve a 40-hour total week, the unions wanted overtime pay for those 2 hours each day that you worked over, even though it was a 40-hour week, because their union says an 8-hour day. Okay. Well, anyway, but working around that, and I think we have successfully, we're pressing to get that one through, and that will come. The other thing was part-time work. Now, we're doing that two ways, and the president already signed off on an order that Scotty Campbell is enforcing. It's been about a couple of months now we did it, to do two things. One is to make every agency higher to the ceiling for part-time work, and all the agencies are committed to it. Plus setting up internally within the civil service a monitoring just of that part-time, at least a career part-time work, not temporary people you bring in for a job, but the permanent part-time position to go ahead and hire up to the ceiling they already have for that. The other half of that, you know, which is important, but you run up against, as all people up on federal employment know, you run up against the ceiling, the maximum number of warm bodies you can have in an agency. Okay. So, but there still was a lot of room to get there. And rhetoric aside, you know, there was room to get there that no one was taking advantage of. First thing was to get all the way up to it. The second half, though, was to begin, and this is something that's ongoing now, development of auditing procedure, which enables you to convert people on the basis of full-time equivalents. Now, I worked in public schools, and that was a natural. That was always done. You always had half teachers, quarter people, because you had all those special teachers running around all the time. And they were never formally assigned to the building. But the way the federal government has always counted people is in terms of warm bodies. Okay? You are a warm body. It didn't matter if you were there a half a day or a whole day or a quarter of a day. You were a warm body. And the procedure that we have online now, and it's a matter of really developing it so you can control, so someday you'll know how many people you have before you convert, is to move to a full-time equivalent. So each agency has a full-time equivalent schedule, and you can mix your workers any way you want, part-time, full-time warm bodies, but you have a full-time equivalent ceiling. Now, that's an accounting procedure that has to be well worked out just so you won't lose your people. No. I also worked in schools and know that when you have that kind of procedure and it's done in a sloppy way, you don't know how many people you have working for you. And so the main thing in doing it is not to lose count. So you have two sets of figures, so the one is really used for control, and that's a full-time equivalent system. Now, this sounds almost, it sounds so damn bureaucratic to even talk about it, but I can't tell you what it took to, how much it took to get there, but how important that is if you're going to make any difference on the bulk of employment opportunities for the bulk of women. Now, and I can't make it sound more interesting than it is. Just if you talk to any federally employed people, they'll tell you that it's important. Oh, I'm sorry. What you're saying is that you are trying to make provision for part-time employment, federal workers in all agencies? Yes. That's quite right. And it's not just Washington, it's the whole country. It's the whole country. Yes, that was 2 months ago, and there's a monitoring system that Scotty Campbell's put into effect, and they're held accountable to increasing the number of part-time workers. That didn't require legislation. All it took was the president to say, please do that. Now, increasing part-time workers up to the ceiling is a matter of the president say, hire this way. That doesn't take legislation, okay? But what takes legislation is the flexi-time proposal. No, it's a memorandum. Oh, if you give me your name and number, I'll send it to you. It's signed about 2 months ago. Yeah. Yeah. No, so it's from the president to do. What he's doing every month, and this is not new, every month, always, they fill out those wonderful personnel reports. Okay. And the monitoring device is on that particular column for part-time permanent workers. And what Scotty is doing with the president is meeting with him to review the progress the agencies are making. Okay? Now, the cabinet meets every week. The opportunity to say something to an agency that's not moving along is there, and he has a mandate to do it. And those who know Scotty know that he would be very aggressive about it. No. Oh, there's nothing new on how to hire part-time workers. They've always done that. That's not new, and they've always had to fill out those accounting procedures. What they haven't had to do is do it. All of the procedures are in place. The main thing that's new, that the point I'm trying to make here, that hasn't been done, is the auditing at the other end by the Civil Service Commission and the monitoring. Am I missing something?
Yeah, well, I think what's more critical is that you still got slots. And it seems to me that the GAO report, which recommends that a certain number of slots be converted to hours and dollars, and that you hire from that batch of people, really make a significant difference. And that I haven't seen except in the GAO report. It seems the logical follow-up to the president's recommendation
to say, well, they are on the full-time equivalent business. They're willing to try out new models. They're going to jump out there for the whole federal government without testing it out. But there's a real, yeah. No, I haven't seen, no, that's not up yet. That's not up. Yeah, for the students. Well, yeah, well, he evidently hasn't gotten the word yet, and I allow for that because it takes time. Yeah. But well, he hasn't gotten it yet, and there'll be some resistance.
Yeah. Could we hold questions until after the presentation that has been at the theater throughout the day? I'm sorry.
And whatever we don't finish, we can sit and talk afterwards, okay? Let's see. Anyway, the starting point is there. Okay, to try to do something about federal employment, that's one little piece of it. The other piece, which is much larger, is the whole civil service reform business. Okay. Now, that's been, if you want to pick the theme for the first year of the administration, it would be reorganization. And if you haven't heard that, so all this stuff, because it hasn't been mentioned enough, I suppose, so reorganization is the main theme. And most of it aimed at trying to improve operations. Now, one reorganization I worked along with was Harriet Jenkins' part of the whole federal employment reorganization. Now, that's a large staff team of people with 5 volumes of paper as a result. Now, what they've been looking at one part of the civil service that I was following was 2 things. One, on enforcement of discrimination complaints within the agency, the highlight of the recommendation. The recommendation there being the same one that Howard Glickstein's group, equal employment thing, to transfer that out of civil service and put it in the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So you're not held in jeopardy if you want to file a discrimination complaint. Yeah. The other thing that they were, several other little other pieces, let me pick up a few. Of course, to upgrade federal women's programs. Now, what they didn't go for, and I have to admit I kind of wanted, it's one of the recommendations of Fairly Employed Women, to have on a formula basis the number of full-time staff working with the women's program. But what they did go for is just upgrading of that program, so that it's not buried in a corner. Remember who they're reporting to. Let me get that right. In the reorganization, I don't think they're in the office of the secretary. I can't remember. I don't think it wasn't pushed that high. Still in the equal employment, the EEO office, whatever it is, as a separate little box. And they pushed up the EEO office. That's how they did that. Yeah, to a higher level. Now, which has its pluses and minuses. Those who wanted the women's program separated from equal employment office, it deals with all discrimination complaints, and those who wanted to keep it together. They went for keeping it together. Let's see. Oh, they've got 3 volumes of it, and I have to apologize. I'm trying to remember enough of this to hit the high points. The major one, this is in terms of access to employment, is of course going to be veterans' preference, which has been a long-standing, sticky problem. Now, I think that it would be extremely naive not to expect a real fight on changing veterans' preference. Those who are up with that one, if you're applying for federal employment, you receive... Oh, as it is now, you have to receive at least an 80 on the test to be even on the eligible list, okay? Now, which means everybody who gets to 80 has a possibility of being interviewed or being in the pool. Now, to be at the very top of the list, it helps if you are a veteran. You receive 5 if you're just a veteran, 10 disabled. Which means that for non-veterans, or primarily women, you have to earn all that on the test. If you are a veteran, you can make up the difference by status alone. Now, when that, I don't know, and those correct me, whether or not any administration is pressed as hard as this one is going to on that point and run the risk and the wrath and be sure it's going to come, you know, of all the veterans groups. You know, it will be there and it will be real. They've already let, you know, they've already done their saber rattling. So you can get, it'll be a tremendous fight. And those who feel strongly about that, I hope you'll be standing there too to help beat back the forces and help win that one, because it will make a great deal of difference. Although the proposals are truly just to limit veterans' preference, not to abolish them. Now, I think the compromise will come on what the limit should be. Whether it should be a one-time thing, 5 years, first entry, there are all sorts of variations on that. But not a lifetime prerogative. That's the thing that's been...